Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today by the INMO General Secretary, Phil Nihay, to discuss the health system, nurses, the winter plan, the budget. And I suppose, first of all, Phil, thanks a million for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
No problem. Delighted to be here.
Great, great. Phil, I just was interested to maybe start by asking you in terms of how does someone end up being the General Secretary of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organization?
Well, it is a post that is publicly advertised and competed for. I took over 2 years ago from Liam Doran, who had been in the post for over 20 years. And I had been working in the union for 18 years myself at that point. Yeah. So we employ, and we had a history of employing working nurses to work for us, but we changed our rules a number of years ago. So we now employ, our competition is broader than employing nurses. A lot of our officials happen to be nurses, and also have, you know, done legal studies and industrial relations and trade union studies. So from our end, we look after all the employment relation matters that nurses or midwives might face, but we also look after professional issues that they might face, particularly fitness to practice, and we take that very seriously, obviously, because that's one of the worst things that'll ever happen to you as a registered professional in your career. And we try very hard to make sure that it's a fair process and that we're there to represent and stand with the nurse or the midwife in the event that that happens. No more than in any other workplace type issue that might arise for them.
And your own back, you actually were a nurse yourself.
I was indeed. I trained in Dublin in Jervis Street, which is now a shopping centre. And no reflection on the nurses that were trained there. I qualified in the late 80s and hit into the recession at that time, where the only thing that was available for many of us was immigration. So I went to London then and worked in London for a number of years and did postgraduate education in intensive care nursing. And from there, then I went to Australia and from there on to America, and worked in both of their health services in intensive care. So I suppose when I came home then in the mid 90s, I was still surprised and taken with the place of nursing in the Irish Health Service. Yeah. I felt that it still was very much a subservient profession. And I had come from working in Australia and the United States, where things had advanced considerably and the nursing voice was at every decision-making table, which is correct. But that wasn't the case in Ireland when I returned. So I quickly became active in the union, the Irish Nurses Organization, as it was at the time, and served my time as branch officer in Dublin, and on and on. And eventually I applied for a job with the union and was appointed as a full-time official in 1998. So I suppose to answer your question, that's how you become involved. You see the workplace issues, you see what you might be able to assist and improve. And I'm still doing that. I'm still looking at the workplace issues and saying, how in the name of God can we have a health strategy? And how can we have a situation where we have a national clinical team looking at how our service deals with COVID-19, for example, and we don't have a senior nurse sitting at the table.
Yeah. And do you think, like, it's interesting, my own self-interest, my mother was a nurse, and, you know, it was, you know, a huge part of our lives growing up, you know, from shift work to, she was a pediatric nurse. And, you know, I just remember, and, you know, talked a lot to her about it and the role she played, and she, you know, was absolutely dedicated to it. But when you look at it, do you think, you know, that question of the valuing of nurses and that idea of, you know, in the past it was like this vocation as opposed to an actual professional role. Do you think that we're at a place now where we do value nurses as professionals within the health system?
I don't, actually. I think the general public value nursing, I think, and particularly I think during the recent exposure to what nurses do and what midwives do and what they try to do to make the patient's journey better during COVID-19. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, it took that pandemic to give us an insight into, in general terms, in society, what place the nurse or the midwife holds. So I don't think that our decision makers, our paymasters, or indeed, in general terms, our industrial relations procedures lend itself to measuring what that contribution means in money terms. So, for example, we've had to take industrial action or strike action to get any progress on the pay scale of nurses over the past 20 years. It's always come about only after a full dispute. And that there must be something wrong with the measurement mechanism for that to be the requirement. So most recently, we had a strike in the beginning of 2019. And the gains that were achieved were hard got, but the implementation of those gains has been equally as difficult. And there is a great resistance to seeing nursing midwifery evolve into the place that it should be at in our management structures. Why is that? I think largely it's back to what you say. People have an old-fashioned opinion that nursing is, you know, in some way almost a vocational type role. In fact, it isn't. It's a job. And for many, nurses are the sole breadwinners in many households. Mm. In other households, you have a very young population now joining. And thankfully, the applications for nursing and midwifery continue to be very high every year. So 5,000 school leavers had nursing or midwifery as their first preference in 2019. We provide 1,700 training places there or thereabouts. So that's good news that people still want to join the professions, want to train. They view it as a profession that they would be interested in, which is great. But they then find themselves in a system which doesn't value their contribution. So for 3 years, many of them are supernumerary in their training, but in fact, they're working. They're not paid. And in fourth year, when they are part of the workforce, they're paid the lowest possible, just slightly above the legal minimum wage to do that role. And that's a really, really important role. It's got a lot of responsibility. And we have sought that student and the fourth year students, particularly who are employees, that their contribution during the pandemic be examined separately to the other contributions, because what we found is many of them felt unsupported during COVID-19, exposed to situations like of real emotional situations that they had not been equipped to deal with. And there's no plan B, there's no backup plan, there's no occupational health facility available to many of them. And they are now making very serious decisions around whether they remain in the profession or not. And that's too big an issue. We need them. We need everybody who trains here to stay in the profession. In fact, we want more to join. So, for example, we met the HSE yesterday and we set out a number of issues that need to be corrected to support the professions who brought the country through a lot of the very difficult situations that we faced during COVID-19. There are increasing evidence that there's a lot of mental health issues. There were over 2,400 nurses infected during since March. And many of them have had post-viral infections that haven't gone away, no more than in general society. But the big issue for them is that they're finding it very difficult to access post-viral clinics, to get support, to get better, cardiac problems, lung conditions, neurological conditions that weren't there before, unable to come back to work. And this is becoming a real, real issue because obviously we were short of nursing prior to March 2020. We know that. And We know that despite politicians from Mary Harney onwards saying, oh, we've plenty of nurses in this country, we just are using them in incorrect locations, that the government's own framework for nurse staffing disproved that and confirmed that we actually do not have enough nurses. And it's not about deploying them. It's about when we have patients who require care, when they have correct staffing levels that are measured based on the patient's dependency, the patient does better. Less people die and people recover quicker. So that argument is done. We have to increase our workforce in order to have better patient outcomes.
And you don't have have figures to hand in terms of, you know, where does Ireland sit as nurses per patient or per head of population?
Well, we know, for example, one of the, there are seven hospital groups. One hospital group met us last week and advised us that there are 400 vacancies in their nursing ranks. And that's just acute hospitals. That isn't care of the older person services. And we know they're extremely short. We know community is very short. And we also know that in 2007, we actually had 1,000 more working nurses on our census than we do today.
1,000 back in 2007, when the population was significantly less and the demand.
Exactly. And when the busyness of our services were not as acute, but also we have a very high spend on agency every week. So the latest figures, again, we received last week from the HSE, staggering in my view, that we're still spending in the region of 1.4 million now a week on nursing, and a similar figure on healthcare assistance.
Because 1.4 million a week on agency hiring.
Yes. Yeah, hiring of agency nurses, and in and around the same figure, maybe slightly less, on healthcare assistance.
Yeah.
So that's a conscious decision not to hire. That's a conscious decision that we have this money, that's a lot of money, and here's how we're going to spend it. Because we know from talking to members who and nurses who very readily gave up their lives in Australia and in the UK and came home to answer Ireland's call, if you like, they've been unable to get direct hire work. They've been redirected to agency and they're very unhappy about it. So that was a conscious decision. That was a financial decision. And all of the international research tells us that patients do not do as well when they do not have a regular rostered workforce. They just simply, the outcomes are poorer.
And you know, that is a very, like, I heard that, you know, during the week, and you know, there was a nurse speaking on the media around that in relation to Ireland's call, like, and I know a lot of people are just like flabbergasted, you know, just and disgusted that, you know, the country would put out this call to health workers from across the world, you know, who would you know, been trained here to come back. And then to realize, you know, months into it, that they've just been left there, as you say, either, you know, been told to go to agency or, you know, not been contacted at all. Like, how has that happened?
Exactly. And it smacks of, I suppose, a policy that puts the finance first, that puts, look, the big push in the public service has been the headcount, and everybody's saying there's too many public servants. Nurses and midwives are in that bracket. They're considered, obviously, public servants. So when any cutback or any moratorium happens, because their numbers and their volume is bigger, they're affected to a greater degree. So if a nursing post becomes vacant and it's not filled, for every other, for most grades in the public sector, that might mean five or six people will be removed. But in nursing, because of the volume, it means that our numbers have dropped dramatically. So proportionately, we have been affected to a much greater degree by moratoriums. So the last moratorium was May 20. The health service will deny that there's a moratorium, but they have circulars issued which state that you cannot recruit and you cannot replace. And what that means is that directors of nursing are unable to fill vacancies because they need approval to put that person on the payroll.
And because I was just going to ask you that if you have 400 vacancies, as you said, in a major hospital, I would have thought when
that's
you
a hospital here, group.
So sorry, it's a number group. Yes, in a number of hospitals, a hospital group, that would mean that you have, you know, essentially posts that are advertised and not being filled.
Or you have posts that you're not authorized to go to ad with, and the process is very slow.
So essentially you're saying that the HSC is not allowing hospitals.
The authority to recruit requires sign off at national senior level. We have been very, I suppose, vocal in criticizing that policy, because when you are dealing with a vacant nursing post or a vacant midwifery post, they're not two a penny. There's a global shortage, and we have to be as competitive as we can be in Ireland in order to get retention right, first and foremost, so that our nurses and midwives don't travel. There is a travel restriction now, but that isn't preventing people going. Smaller numbers are leaving, but at the same time, there is still huge recruitment. The UK government in the last week have introduced huge incentives to recruit from abroad, and they look to Ireland very, very quickly because they know the calibre of nurse or midwife that trains here. They're trained in an English-speaking model. They're familiar with Western medicine. Therefore, they're very attractive to the UK market. So they constantly come here to recruit and offer very attractive packages. They offer a shorter working week. They offer postgraduate education. In many instances, they offer accommodation on arrival. And in the meantime, we're saying to nurses in Ireland, join an agency, and we might give you a couple of hours whenever we're short. And like, it just makes absolutely no sense that we're not out there seeking to provide direct employment at the best possible situation that we can to keep nurses from traveling abroad, but also to make sure that ultimately our rosters are correctly filled. Like, I'm constantly hearing from nurses, and our representatives are constantly hearing from nurses and midwives where they go on night duty and they might have 30 patients and they're supposed to have 3 or 4 on a roster and they might have 2, and some of them might not be trained that long and they're very nervous about that. It's incorrect. It's unsafe. And that piece hasn't really been dealt with properly. So the strike we had last year was to look at a system of determining how many nurses you need. For midwifery, it's different. There's a different measurement. There is an agreement, it's government policy, that we now have a measurement tool that determines how many nurses you need based on the patient's dependency. So if you're in hospital, you're then guaranteed that because you're in ward X or ward Y, and that ward has sick patients, very sick patients, and there's a mix, that is then used to determine the skill mix and the nursing needs per patient. That includes the mix of healthcare assistant and nursing. All of that is worked out. It's government policy. It's accepted as being very safe. And interestingly, in the areas where it was piloted over 2 years, it saved quite a considerable amount of spend on agency. It reduced the agency spend to 0.2%. It improved retention, and it also saved money because patients got better quicker. And the readmission rate reduced, the reinfection rate reduced, all of the good stuff. Everybody knows this research. It's been presented to the Department of Health. It was conducted by UCC independently, University College Cork, and very impressive, but a great reluctance to fund its implementation. So in the budget this year, again, we have reminded the Department of Finance that this is an area that they need to invest in order to look to the future and say patients will have better outcomes in Irish hospitals because the staffing is determined scientifically. The Department of Finance are on the record as stating that they are not a fan of multi-annual funding. So in order for this system to be introduced. You can't just say, here's your budget, HSE, and this is what you have to spend in this calendar year, because this requires investment this year that will reap you the benefit maybe next year.
Yeah.
And that requires a multi-annual approach to budgeting for the health service, which, again, we promote. We've, in our pre-budget submission to the department, again, emphasised that point. And without it, we're constantly going to be chasing our tail and relying on agency. If you look at education, they, for example, have a pupil-teacher ratio. What we're saying is that's correct. That's forward planning. You're looking at how many pupils you're going to have next year, and then you adjust your workforce. What is so wrong with doing exactly the same in healthcare when it's actually people's lives you're dealing with? And it's proven to have a better outcome when you base it on a scientific measurement.
I think you make a very strong case there. And, you know, I think it's very, you know, interesting to present it in that way. And I think that because a lot of the narrative coming now, and, you know, we're obviously seeing a very welcome increase in investment, particularly with the winter plan. But in reality, what you're saying is that we need substantially more if we're actually going to provide the quality, you know, healthcare, which requires, as you say, the proper, you know, employment, recruitment, retention of nursing staff. And, you know, if you look at it, this issue of multi-annual funding essentially is that, okay, they're allocating 600 million this year to the winter plan, but there's no guarantee that that will happen the following year. So therefore, you can't employ someone on a permanent, or, you know, what could be or should be a permanent.
Up to April of next year. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't. So that's why you have this reliance on agency staff, because it's constantly short-term response rather than biting the bullet and going, actually, we're going to fund a proper public health system.
I think the winter plan, and we had a discussion with the HSE yesterday on this with their senior management team. And to be fair, I think they're looking at, they have great aspirations. You know, we will have a zero tolerance for overcrowding, for example, is one of the statements, which we subscribe to. We say, great, excellent. How are you going to do it?
Yeah.
Considering 2 days this week, you've had over 60 patients in one hospital alone in the country. And what does zero tolerance mean? So when that happens, what do you do next?
Yeah.
You have a statement in your...
How did they respond?
They're saying that they're looking into it and they're examining, you know, the availability of additional beds. The bottom line is nobody has been able to tackle the overcrowding in emergency departments because capacity just does not meet the needs of the growing population in the country. And Sláintecare and its whole premise is we still need additional acute beds in acute hospitals, because people, for certain periods of their illness, obviously they need to be in acute hospitals. But with the best will in the world, we are not going to be at a level in the community that will relieve that pressure over this winter. Not a hope. And there's no point in saying in a winter plan, we will have a zero tolerance approach unless you then have a plan to deal with situations when they arise. Because it's really scary to think about a hospital with 60 patients, some on chairs, some on trolleys, in the midst of a normal winter, never mind when you all have COVID. It's unsafe for those patients, and it's unsafe for the staff who are looking after them. And ignoring it isn't an option. So in our view, we have to look at reducing the services down to what we did in March, unless we can prove that overcrowding will not be needed. Because when patients come to an emergency department requiring treatment, the patients we count every day are those that are admitted. So we're not just counting people sitting in the waiting room. We're counting people who actually are sick enough that they need to be in hospital. And when you have 60 patients in that category for whom there are no beds at, you know, the beginning of September, you wouldn't have to be working in the health service to know that that's going to go one way unless there's real interventions. And the interventions we're looking for are that funding is made available for additional beds and additional staff, because none of the beds that are announced as opening over the next number of months will happen unless the recruitment plan. And we don't, as late as yesterday, the HSE could not tell us what numbers and what process of recruitment, which is more important, they're going to engage in.
Yes, and I think that that's a question that, you know, we have the situation where we have staff in the country now, or potentially staff who came back, for example, for Ireland's call, who we could potentially actually say, you know, convince to stay here in Ireland and work in the health system rather than returning, as you're saying, and there's going to be graduates as well. There is staff in the country that could be hired on, and obviously as well from agencies, taken on permanently. What sort of numbers should we be and could we hire if the money was put into it?
Well, we know, for example, from the studies that were done in the framework that I was just discussing with you, which set out how many. So for your average surgical ward, so you have 28 to 30 beds. In the two hospitals that were looked at, they needed an uplift of about 8 to 12 whole-time equivalent nursing posts.
Yeah.
So we are short. We do have a shortage already in one hospital group. You know, they've said to us 400 nursing vacant posts. So you can't introduce additional beds from that starting point. So we have to fill the vacancies, and then we have to look at how do we staff additional beds that are needed and required. And we have to be more flexible with our workforce. We have to look at what keeps people in work. And let's face it, it is a very difficult physical job. It's a physically demanding job. It's very difficult to continue working shift pattern when you're entering into your later years. And we need to look at very innovative ways of keeping people in the workplace, including looking at retirement ages, looking at making it much more flexible to have periods of time where you might not be able to work full time for caring reasons. All of those issues need to be addressed, because 92% of the workforce is female. And we know, for example, rosters on any given day in any acute hospital, there are 2 to 3% of the workforce, the nursing workforce, on maternity leave. So that's a huge number who are not available to the ward, but are employees. So we have to have contingency plans to backfill and to make sure that we have enough of a workforce to make the daily work safe. And imagine, I think it would be nirvana to every nurse and every midwife if they went into work tonight or tomorrow morning and they had full complement of staff. I'd say most of the graduates in the last 15 years have never experienced that. So that makes the working day very difficult. It makes your practice very unsafe, and it makes your long-term view of your profession very negative. And what we're trying to do in conjunction with the HSE and the Department of Health is correct that. Turn it around. Give us a measurement tool, which we now have, which the previous Minister for Health, Minister Harris, launched with great accolade and spoke very positively about the basis on which it measured the workforce that was needed. Well, then fund that and implement it. And that's the starting point. We then can move into the next number of years knowing that things are going to get better.
I think that you've set out quite clearly what needs to be done there, Phil. And I think that, you know, it's clear that people will be watching the budget to see, you know, does that take place? Do you think that just in terms of achieving this, if politicians and government aren't listening, and they are, it's not that they're not listening, they are listening, and they're hearing it, but not acting on it and not putting the investment behind it. And it's clear that, you know, there's a lot of consensus now, for example, around Sláinte Care, around the need to properly invest in the public health system. But the problem, as with many issues in Ireland, is the lack of implementation. that, you know, how do you see, how does the INMO see itself moving forward in to try and pressure further to get the actual recruitment to take place and the investment to take place to actually provide proper, you know, working conditions, attractive system in place that we retain nurses and we actually achieve the level of nursing staff that a proper health system should have?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I think the point is that we're committed to, and I think most people in the country will see that the public service is the delivery model of choice. Sláintecare is right in that. So we've just come through a very serious pandemic, and I think I was extraordinarily impressed with the good outcomes for patients who had to be admitted to ICU, for example. Numbers that recovered from COVID-19 that were nursed back to health were very impressive. And on the international stage, we compared very favorably. So we got it right. We did all of that very well. But that then needs to be understood as the requirement to invest in the public health service. So we have, I don't think the current roadmap for Sláintecare, I think it's too slow. I think the investment for there's a lot of legacy debt in the HSE and the transitional fund that was required, again, very little investment in the last two budgets in respect of really, if we want Sláintecare, we have to fund it properly. We have to look at the numbers. We have to look at the areas where investment has been hampered because obviously the areas that require most of the money every winter are the same areas. So we increase home care, we increase long-term care beds around September, October every year to try and get the numbers down. But it's patching as opposed to forward planning and long-term planning to improve for next year. So next year, we'll have exactly the same issue. Now, the funding this year is much higher because of the requirement to provide COVID services and non-COVID services. And it looks like that's going to be a requirement into, at the very earliest, the middle of next year. So this, I suppose, from our end, what do? We have a very sophisticated and good system of industrial relations and dispute management in this country. We have, for example, tomorrow we're before the Labour Relations Commission, the 30th of September, just in case this is going out at a later point. Yeah, yeah. And we have referred the lack of adherence to agreements that have been made on behalf of nurses and midwives with this organisation as a dispute. Mm. And our view is that the employer has to engage properly and has to set in place the funding allocation, the how. How are you going to recruit? Where are you going to recruit to? And what is the process you will use? Because currently the process is too cumbersome, too long. It takes between 4 and 6 months from a post becoming vacant to have it refilled. That requires either beds to close or staff to work short. And that's not acceptable. And that's what causes strikes. And that's what the health service doesn't need. Additional workplace agitation when there is an alternative that can avoid it.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thanks so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic. That was a really useful and interesting conversation. And I think it will, really show people, I think, highlight again the value of the nursing profession and what needs to be done to, you know, really achieve that proper public health system. So thank you so much for joining us today.
And I think hopefully will say to a lot of our young people who are entering the profession, it's a great profession to join. It's a fantastic job. And we take great pride as the union representing nurses and midwives in saying, and we're there with you every step of the way. So in general terms, I always like to say nurses and midwives, join a union, join the INMO, and to workers in general, you're better served when you're a union member.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's where we leave you for another episode of Reboot Republic. Just a reminder, these podcasts across the Tortoise Shack, including the Echo Chamber, Policed, Glow West, Pack Woman, and now the COVID Care podcast, all rely on you guys. It is patreon.com/tortoiseshack. This is a very large project, an accidental platform, but we would really appreciate if you put your hands in your pocket and show us the support that we need to keep going. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.